Hey, y'all, if you enjoy watching your podcast, which seems kind of weird, watching your podcast, but some people really enjoy that. So we have a YouTube channel. You can find it at Heather Parady, P-A-R-A-D-Y. It's also linked up in the show notes. You can hit subscribe. And several of these interviews are actually in person, so you can watch that. Again, that is at Heather Parady on YouTube.
Carlos Andres Cuervo is a Colombian cinematographer and documentary filmmaker. His exceptional storytelling has won him recognitions and accolades from prestigious institutions, and his films have been showcased in places like Sundance Film Festival, South by Southwest, Raindance Film. I could keep going. He's passionate about shedding a light on untold stories and amplifying voices that often go unheard. I met him on a film set hunting souls back over the pandemic. And I'll tell you what, this guy was so freaking passionate. I don't think I've ever seen somebody radiate as much energy and excitement for his work as Carlos did. I've been bothering to have him on the show for like 2 years. Finally, I got to sit down in his home studio and have a very honest conversation, probably one of my favorite to date, about capturing the heart of a story as a creative, the real meaning behind the work that we do, and how to deal with burnout even when you love creating. Pull out your tissues on this one because your girl even cried in this interview.
If you invest in quality, you come short. You better invest in your vision because you can buy quality, but where are you going to go and buy your vision? Nobody's forcing you to hustle to the place where you not only dislike what you like, but you dislike who you are. El Señor es mi pastor, nada me faltará. The Lord is my shepherd, I should lack nothing. Mm. He made me lay down in green paths, because sometimes we don't want to lay down.
Preach.
You know, sometimes we have to be made to lay down, to rest.
Carlos, goodness sakes. Photojournalist, filmmaker, educator, years and years in the industry as a professional creative, and you've chosen to use your craft, your skill set, to share stories of people who may not have their story told. I know with your work in various countries and documents, I want to definitely dig into that. But I first met you on a production a couple years ago with our mutual friend Diego, and I am not exaggerating when I say that you are one of the most passionate creatives I've ever met, because every few minutes, hour, whatever, you would like turn the corner and you had something to show somebody, some new idea. We're in the middle of a film and you're taking photos and you're sharing stories of these people you met on Instagram. And I was just like, this guy is so passionate. He loves what he does. And I love seeing lit up people. Mm. I believe in calling with all my heart, that God puts calling on our life. And it's cool seeing you operate in that. And big intro, but all that to say, since I met you, I was like, I want to sit down and hear his story and find out how he got here and what your vision is, you know, for your art and your creativity. So thank you. You didn't have to say yes. You didn't have to jump on this camera in your nice studio and let me interview you. So thanks for your time today.
Awesome. And I'm glad you're here because you're the first one to use the studio.
Woo-hoo. So it's nice, isn't it? Super nice.
The idea. And this is just one of many ideas. Yeah. And sometimes I've struggled sometimes with fear of the future. You know, that's one of my main fears. In rats, but fear of the future. And I think fear of the future kind of paralyzes people.
You know? Yeah.
And the way you kind of break through from that is by acting on your ideas. Mm. Not all of them are successful, but just the fact that you're trying makes a difference.
Yeah. You know?
And so this time around, I'm trying to create a space in my own house, like I was telling you, to remove the friction that there is. I'm like, I have to put cameras and lights.
Now you got no excuse now.
And like, now I have everything set up. Yeah. And it's a matter of like, what am I going to do with it?
What are you going to do with
it? And so it's a gift that we have. Mm-hmm. You know, like you said, it's a calling
and it's a
gift. It's a gift from God. And our gift back is what we do with that gift.
Ooh, you know, this is already getting good. We're already at church.
And so, but I think my gift back is like, there's so many people that are great creators. They just don't have the the space, the platform. And so maybe it's not about me necessarily talking about what I do or creating my own things, but creating a platform for others, you know, to catapult others, you know, it's to also express their creativity. And I believe, like, even in the different things that I do, you mentioned our mutual friend, Diego. Sometimes we go to events with Diego and he's like, you're like a beauty queen. You're always saying hi to everyone. It's like, everybody
knows.
I'm like, it's not, I just see, I grew up in a family that was very socially oriented. You know, my dad was a pastor for many years and he chose to work with drug addicts, with people that were homeless, you know. He chose that because he could have, you know, worked in a traditional church, you know, but he chose. So I was always exposed to, even on vacations, my dad will stop and greet somebody on the streets. And even if they're smelly or whatever, hug them and stuff. So I grew up seeing that. I think it translates to my awareness of the story that is behind the different people I meet, you know, and the potential that you see.
Because
sometimes, like, you see these gems surrounded by dirt and cold and stuff. And it just takes a little bit of polishing.
Yeah. Know?
To really see the value and the gold and the gems that is on people. So I think it goes the same with creatives. There's many people that say, oh, I wasn't born creative. It's just a matter of like polishing some of that.
Yes.
There's a seed of creativity in all of us because we were created, so we are creative, you know? And it's just a matter of like polishing that, pulling that, calling the gold out of... It doesn't matter the condition. There's people like, I'm zero creative. No, there's something.
Yes.
You just have to just find it and polish it, you know. And sometimes there are multiple areas. I think I'm good in the technical aspect of things.
Yes, you know, are.
With the lights and the cameras.
It's wild.
But I also recognize that there is a gift that goes beyond that.
Yeah.
You know? And I want to explore that on myself. And just like a mad scientist, I'm just testing it with myself first before I can test it with other people. And one of the projects that I want to record in the studio is learning the stories behind what people do as a job, you know, or what I know them for. I know many directors and directors of photography and actors, but just like myself, you know, I'm a director of photography, but I'm also a urban farmer.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And I'm exploring that.
Right.
And I'm finding in that, you know, also part of my identity is in that. And I'm exploring. I'm in the process of knowing myself within that context. And I want to do the same. I want to provide this space so people can also find within different contexts where the creativity can flourish.
Yeah. You opened up starting with fear. And I'll speak for myself. When I kind of owned up to the fact that I wanted to be creative with my life, there was so much fear, imposter syndrome. It seems like such an industry that's so hard to break into and actually make a living doing it. And I think we tell children that. I mean, usually as a society, like, hey, you know, you're going to get a serious job. You're not going to put down the paintbrush, Paul, you know. It's fostering that belief in yourself that, you know what, I can do this with my life. I'm curious with you, when you noticed, hey, I have a knack for positioning and the technical side and visual storytelling. When did you notice that in yourself? Was it a young boy? And then when did you start fostering that seriously?
I believe, you know, I remember being 14 and writing for the main newspaper in my country, like a little poem. And they published it in the main newspaper. And I was like, wow, I'm 14 and I already
That's cool.
something in the main newspaper. But I was also a very troubled kid at school. I went through like five different schools before I graduated.
Why?
From very hyperactive, you know, very energetic. And I was a good student, you know, for the most part. I was getting straight A's, but it was lack of what they will call at the time discipline. It was this time where nobody really talked about ADHD or any kind of like hyper syndrome of like, it was just he's not a disciplined person. So they'll have to call my parents. And one or two teachers saw that as a potential to kind of refocus that energy. And I noticed like they gave me positions of leadership.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it challenged me now to kind of refocus my energy, because now there is people looking at me and there are responsibilities and there, you know, things that it was more like, instead of blaming me and shaming me, it was like, I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to honor you and place you in a position where you're going to refocus your energy. I think that's what was their intention. I don't think they did it for another thing, that just to show me like, hey, no, you are more than your behavior, you know? And that really, because I was sad. I was really sad because my behavior kind of detached me from people.
Other people.
You know?
Yeah.
People didn't want to hang out with me because I was always in trouble, you know? Really crazy. I mean, crazy things for my age as a teenager.
Yeah.
My dad took me to a missionary trip in Cuba at the age of 14 or something. And he did it mostly to spend time with me and have those one-on-one conversations that a teenager should have with a dad.
That's special. You
know? And I was like, that really made a difference. You know,
yeah.
I felt like I wasn't just calling attention. A few people, not everybody, but there was a few key people that saw beyond that and really call out this, what I was telling you, like these good things out of me. And that's when I recognized, you know, I like communications. I like art. I was into rock, ska, punk.
'90s. Let's go.
And I had a band and I was, you know, writing for a magazine at that time. And then the main newspaper bought a TV franchise from Canada. And that's how I started into, you know, a little bit of pre-production. I graduated from the journalism school that newspaper founded in Colombia, my home country. And it took from there, like at age 17, I was working at the newspaper.
Wow.
Finishing or graduating from high school and having my band. But I was going to school and then right after that going to work, because I was still doing 40 hours a week in the newspaper and going to school at the same time at 17. So it took a lot of discipline. Like once I recognized this is the path that I want to go, I was like very focused. But I was also burned out. At a young age, I was like, this
is
just too much.
Yeah.
And so I kind of took a break from media and the arts. And I went to Puerto Rico and I was studying there. And one day they were looking at the resumes from the students that applied to the school, and they find out that I was in media, and that was my last day gardening at the school, because you have to like work at the school as well if you were an international student. And they're like, well, since you're good in media,
they put you to work.
Yeah, they put me to work 4 years in the media department at that school, and it was amazing.
Is that when you started working with cameras and stuff?
That was when I started doing documentary work. You know,
that so young.
I did documentaries in Central Asia, in China, all over Central America. I visited like 14 countries during those four years that I was in school. And again, I got burnt out at the end of my school.
How come?
I was like, I feel like many creatives have that pursuit of the new thing.
Yes.
And once you settle for something that even at the beginning tastes like awesome, and you know, once it becomes like common to you, and you become to get adjusted to it, and that's why one of the reasons I feel I flourish more as an independent filmmaker and as a freelancer than working on a regular 9-to-5. Like I now understand that I'm not wired for that, and I'm not saying that everybody has got to be an entrepreneur now, but I'm saying there's people who flourish who are very miserable going to these schemes, you know, going to these patterns. You know, once I start finding patterns, I just feel like I want to break the pattern and try something different. And I feel like that's my creative energy inside just telling me like, it's time to shift, it's time to change. And it's like a season, you know.
Yeah.
Once I get into this, then I find myself boxed into something. I'm like, I gotta try something different. Even if it moves, even if it means moving from Miami to Atlanta and not having friends or family, just moving my wife and my kids here to the unknown. For me, that was like, okay, a reset to the 12 years that I was in Miami working in media. So again, many things at the same time, but basically once I recognized that I had a calling for media, then I focus on that. But I got burned out several times. So it's almost like I have to refocus.
Focus. You know? Yeah. That's so real.
And it happens with cameras as well. You know, sometimes the sensor and it's not aligning properly with the lens and you need to adjust for the back focusing. Mm. So even if you're using that camera all the time, with time, you just have to adjust it and refocus. And I think as creatives, there's seasons for us that we have to adjust the focus and see what new direction we're going to want to go.
That's so good. I'm curious, it sounds as though you started off your kind of creative venture in writing. Mm-hmm. And then when you got into this media department, you started making films. So is it safe to say that your sweet spot is working specifically with cameras, or do you still tap into the writing side?
Well, I think the pathway was the writing because I understood the value of story.
Oh, boy.
Right?
Yeah.
I understood crafting a story first in my mind and in paper. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to journalism school, I was like, I want to try something that complements what I'm already working on. And I studied photojournalism.
Okay.
And out of 27 students, only 4 of us graduated.
Why? How come?
It was hard. The hardest teacher ever. Wow. He would look at the picture and say, this is a vomit. This is
no.
Hard. What are you doing? It was one of those like really challenging professors because he was a foreign journalist at the newspaper. He wasn't a teacher or, you know, from university with experience. Yeah. He was a professional working in the industry of journalism. He took the pictures when Pablo Escobar was assassinated on the roof of his house in Medellin and sold them to Associated Press and Reuters. And so he very, very accomplished photographer. And he was expecting nothing but
perfection.
The level of photography than he was surrounded with. He didn't see us as, oh, another student. He's like, that's unacceptable. You work at the main newspaper in your country. That's.
And you didn't get discouraged from that.
No, I was challenged.
You liked it.
I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to show you, you know? Okay. And I felt challenged to do things that other peers didn't see. And I already had so much criticism in my life at that point, being so young, but criticized by the way I look, by my style of music that I was listening to.
Hyperness, energy. Yeah.
I just, at that point, I was like, I can care less about what these people are saying. I'm just going to prove myself, prove other people that I can do what it takes. You know? So I graduated from that. And like I told you, the newspaper bought the TV franchise. And that's, so I went from writing to photography to TV.
Wow.
That kind of transition. By the time I was in Puerto Rico doing the documentaries, it was like, oh, this is my passion because I can tell like real life stories like I was doing with the newspaper, but in visuals, you know, that are so minority groups, indigenous groups, like all those kinds of things that I was able to work. I did a couple of documentaries that went to festivals and, you know, small things like that, but that paved the way.
So cool.
And you saw one of my stickers that says, "What will Deakins do?"
Yeah, yeah.
So Roger Deakins is a very renowned cinematographer in the industry of filmmaking. He's British, actually, Sir Roger Deakins. And many people look up to Roger Deakins, and Roger Deakins had a very similar path. He started with photojournalism.
Interesting.
He worked as a photojournalist for many, many years doing documentary work, and then he branched into narrative. And he's one of the most sought after cinematographers in the world with an incredible, you know, resume of movies. And he started as a photojournalist. And so I think that's very similar path for some people.
Elementary question, but I'm curious, what did photojournalism teach you about storytelling that gives you an edge now?
Well, I think photojournalism is very reflective.
Okay.
And then it trains your heart as well as your mind and your
eye. Tell me more. What do you mean?
You know, I believe that many times where we're writing a story or crafting a story, we have so many ideas and so many different characters. Mm-hmm. but it doesn't really come to fruition until we find the heart of the story.
Oh boy.
And the heart of the story can be a person, for example, can be the protagonist, or can, the heart of the story can be a place as well. If our story, like the place becomes the heart, and then everything else is just like secondary to that story. When you are a photojournalist, once you find the heart of the story, like everything around it has to serve the story or the heart of that story. And that's one of the flaws in some movies and some filmmakers, that sometimes they want to show so much that they disregard the heart of the story.
That's so good.
And so when I shoot, sometimes we think of creators as like limitless opportunities and options.
Yeah.
But that actually affects your level of creativity. Sometimes limiting or putting boundaries will help you to be a better creative, because then it focuses more towards the heart of the story. So instead of bringing 20 characters and trying to address all those, it's like, yeah, those 20 characters are helping advance the story, or like the heart of the story. That is this character, or is this city, or is this situation. That could be the heart of the story as well. And that's what people take away at the end of a movie or at the end of a show. It's if they take something else that is not the heart of the story, maybe we didn't do our best job, you know, to really focus on that. And I think that happens a lot in photojournalism, because you have story, a specific story to tell, and you have facts that you have to give with the story. So you have to be very pragmatic, very practical. In journalism, they call it the five W's, you know, these five questions that will allow you to understand what you're talking about.
What are the five questions?
So is the who. So who is, this is the heart of the story. And the who or the what. And then when is this happening? The context of the situational context in terms of time.
Okay.
When is this happening? And then where. So is that that environment, you know, that that is surrounding the story, that is also important, and that also answers some of and then we have the why.
Why?
So the reasons why these things are happening, which many times as creatives, we're thinking about the what. What do I need? You know, what equipment do I need? You know, how can I improve my metrics? You know, we don't think of the why.
Oh, that can preach.
What is the reason behind? You know, once you find a why, it's almost like, oh, I found the heart, you know, of my story, you know, and then reality and the rest of that comes second to that, you know. So one of the reasons I haven't started doing the content in my own house and stuff is because I always strive for, like, I want the best quality possible. But I learned from one of my mentors that if you invest in quality, you come short. You better invest in your vision. Because you can buy quality. Quality is just buying a better camera, a better microphone, hiring people that will bring, you know, quality to the kind of things that you do. But where are you going to go and buy your vision? You know, that comes from you. And if you invest more on your vision than in the quality, quality will come. Like you'll get the resources to buy the quality you need. Unfortunately, many of us buy the narrative that we have to invest in quality. And we're not ready until we have the latest and greatest. And I need that new iPhone to shoot my content because that's when I'm going to be good, you know? And we forget about finding that why.
The heart.
And the heart of the story that that really makes a difference. You know? And so I think those things in journalism helped me develop also empathy to my characters, which in this case were not characters of a story. It's like real life situations that are happening. But empathy, there is a very sad story of a photojournalism that went to a famine in, to document a famine in Africa. And what was reported, and there are different versions of the story, but what was reported is that he saw these vultures going after little kids, like waiting for them to pass and die. So, because the vultures are, you know, very predatory animals, but also very opportunistic animals. And kids were trying to make it to the distribution center.
Oh, God.
And he sat down, smoked a cigarette, thinking about it, looking at the scene, waiting for the vulture to open the wings to make the picture more dramatic. And capture an image that is unbelievable. It just speaks so much. And he got nominated for the Pulitzer Prize and won. And he got so many accolades. Sadly, he committed suicide after, you know, winning this many accolades in his house. He wrote in the suicidal note that the bad things, the horror, the heaviness, the pain of this world is so heavy that it overcomes the joy that you can have in life.
Wow.
Because sometimes we can be spectators of what is happening around us.
Hmm.
Great at documenting what is happening, the pain and the joy, but we're not as good as to become or like step away from just being spectators to be protagonists of the stories that we're telling. You know, there is a fine line.
That's heavy.
Yeah. There's a fine line when you're a photojournalist because you're not supposed to intervene. You know, you're not so, but sometimes you just have to be compassionate and let that humanity and that the fact that you want to get that picture is important. But the fact that there's suffering and that you can do something about it, it goes just beyond, you know? And so I think photojournalism, if you allowed it, will let you get the opportunity to be more compassionate.
Yeah.
And I think storytellers with compassion are very close to finding the heart and people can identify with those stories.
Wow. You know?
Because we're taught as storytellers that conflict is what advances the story.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a movie that has no conflict, it just becomes boring.
Mm-hmm.
A movie with a lot of constant conflict, solving problems, and that is life. You know, you wake up and the rest of the day is just going from one thing to another, solving one issue, making one decision after another. It's conflict. So as a foreign journalist, you have limited resources.
Yeah.
Many times you're by yourself. And those limitations helped you focus also in what's important. Sometimes when you're in the film industry, you have big crews.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has their role.
Mm-hmm.
And there you try to make, you know, the role of somebody else or move this C-stand, you know. But that creates that conformity, you know, to the mundane. Once you break out of that, you are basically free to find a story.
When you entered into these worlds, you're a young man and you're going to these brand new countries and experiencing things you've probably never seen before and experienced before. I'm curious, when you think about finding the heart of a story, when you're presented something so big and so massive, and maybe there's micro stories within the big narrative of this story, and I'm sure you experience that too with your work. Now you go into, you know, here's our mission. It's really big, you know, and finding like that tiny little heartbeat in the midst of so much noise and chaos. I'm curious how you like approach that, how you learned to approach it when you were documenting.
It's good to have this kind of exercises because they're like disciplines that kind of help. Again,
okay,
it's something that you can exercise that help you focus. That's all. It's not a rule that you have to follow every single time. Sometimes it doesn't work, but sometimes it does work, which is I start writing keywords related to the story. And I start narrowing down those keywords until I end up with at least five of them.
Give me an example.
An example could be, I want to tell an immigration story.
Okay.
An immigration story about what? Well, there's hundreds of people coming through the Mexican border, you know, okay? And so I start writing Mexican border, immigration story, single mothers, drug dealers. I have entrepreneurs that are coming, Chinese, Asians.
Brain dump. Just a brain dump.
Bunch of
okay.
stuff. And then I start narrowing down what is unique, you know?
What is
really
unique?
Calls importance at the story? What has been told before that it's calling attention out of this whole list? And I start narrowing down. And I say, well, I want to tell the story of this kid. So what kid? Well, there's a group of 10, but out of those 10, what is the heart of the story? And I start narrowing down until I find, okay, I want to tell the story of Fernando. Fernando is a kid who crossed the border as an unaccompanied minor.
Mm-hmm.
Looking for his parents in Homestead, Florida.
Okay.
And Fernando came to the United States. And you think, oh, that's great. It's a story about immigration. But the documentary, and I'm talking about Paper Children, a specific example, wasn't even about him crossing the border. It wasn't even about that aspect of immigration. It was about how is the life for an immigrant once they're here, once you have to go through the whole process of immigration that is not set on your favor to succeed. Mm. It's more on your side to fail. And so it's a very interesting way to explore a story in a very different way. How can we make it that is not political, but is focused on the reality of what somebody goes through? How can we make it to where anybody can relate to the humanity of the story, whether they are immigrants themselves or not?
Yeah.
You know, and that comes from exercises like, let's have an idea board and let's start narrowing down. Let's put more limits, you know.
More if limits.
Creativity is like a river that flows. It's amazing, right? But if a river doesn't have boundaries, it becomes what?
Yeah.
A flood.
Right.
And it can make chaos and it can make damage. But if you put some boundaries to it, it can take you somewhere and be productive and people can come and benefit from the river going with a cause, you know.
You should write a book. I'm just saying. All right.
Those kind of practical things, like I get my 5 keywords, and then when I shoot, I have those keywords in a paper.
You return back to it.
Exactly. And then I say, oh, wow, look at this beautiful thing. It doesn't align with my keywords. Okay, let me read.
I was going to ask you about that, because one thing I'm working on right now, I'm trying really, trying really hard is like counterproductive, but working on opening myself up more to ideation process and playful mind, my creativity, my curiosity, imagination. Yeah. And that's something I have to develop because I'm very type A and organized. So it's like opening the river. It's like letting the river flow and paying attention. Yeah. But then when you get into a project and you get really focused in on something, it's interesting to think about how do we cultivate openness and like letting the muse, letting God flow through you while still having like a narrow focus. Because I sometimes go in like this and then it becomes lifeless.
Yes.
Because I'm not open. But you don't want to be too open because to what you said, then you lose the heartbeat. So how do you navigate
that? I think it starts on this first thing of like you open to everything, ideas. And there's a great book. It's called Jumpstart Your Brain.
Okay.
It's from the Disney Imagineers.
Okay.
So it's Disney Imagineers and most creatives at Disney will study that book. And part of what they do to create these things and ideas is they'll have like a brainstorming party.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Right? And so the idea is to stimulate your senses.
Okay.
Because most of the time you say, oh, let me sit down. Let me come up with an idea for a show. Mm-hmm. And you're sitting down with a blank piece of paper.
Yep.
And you're just looking at the time go and then almost nothing comes, like you're blocked. But when you open your senses, when you have your chocolates and you put your cool music and then you put colored lights around you and maybe you're in a comfortable place or maybe you try going to the swimming pool or maybe you're in the shower and there's music or there's the sound of the water and then when you stimulate your senses, ideas will start to flow. And not all those ideas are great.
Right.
Many stupid ideas. But do not discard those ideas because maybe that dumb idea mixed with another one is what you needed for one of those keywords that you need.
Yeah.
So it starts very loosely in macro and you have to be open to that. Stimulate, you know, when you're working with other coworkers, creating a space where your brain is stimulated and then narrow it and then bring those boundaries, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like a tool that is well used.
Yeah.
I always refer to this metaphor of a knife in the hands of a thief or somebody that wants to do harm can kill somebody. Mm-hmm. But put that same knife in the hands of a doctor and he can bring life, you know? So like media is just a tool.
Right.
What we do with it and the message that we can communicate is what really makes a difference. So as any other tool, just learn ways to use it, you know?
Yeah.
But what you do with it is what's important. And that comes from narrowing and focusing and understanding your audience and understanding yourself and understanding your limitations and embracing those limitations so you can make them work to your favor as boundaries to your creativity. But it can all work as open the floodgates, let the water flow, and then start putting those boundaries so that you get where at least where you hope you can
get. That's good.
You know?
You make these documentaries through your school. Mm-hmm. Where do you go from there?
I went to Laredo, Texas. And I was,
Texas? Yep. What?
From Puerto Rico to Texas. I was a middle school teacher.
No way, really?
Yes, because again, I had to reset my mind. I was tired of media.
I mean, that was a lot, traveling and probably seeing all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
And while I was a teacher, very challenging environment in the border between Mexico and the U.S. Laredo, Texas is a border town where the Zetas are. Mm. They have like a stronghold in that area. Mm. And when they knew I'm from Colombia, they're like, this is just like us, another narco coming here. I'm like, no, not really. One of my students will come and say, hey, Mr. C, I couldn't do the homework porque mi mom tiene un pain in la back. I'm like, what are you talking? He's like this, they call it the pocho language. It's a mix between English and Spanish. He said, no, I didn't do the homework because my dad was killed in the truck. I'm like, you shouldn't. And sure enough, they burned the dad alive in his truck. Like things like this. Some of my students, they come from different moms and they have the same dad.
You needed a brain break. How was this a brain break?
Drug lord had like different wives and the kids from different families were all my students and they were like brothers. And some stories that I was like, why did I come here to the Texas, you know?
Wow.
But I learned a lot. I matured a lot in under those circumstances. And I found students that were just as rebellious and just as, you know, lacking discipline as I was when I was a teenager.
Mm.
And I remember, what did make the difference for me?
The teachers who believed
put them,
in leadership.
Put them in. So
wow.
I start involving them in media as well. And we started a podcast in 2004 where barely YouTube was on.
Yeah.
And Apple had podcasts and you had to apply to the Apple store to get your podcast. So I started a podcast called Vida Extrema. My company even today is called Vida Extrema because of that experience that I had in Laredo, Texas. I recruit some of my students and the people that were working with me to be the host of the show. We will do interviews and live concerts and music. And it just took off.
Did they love it?
They loved it. But some of the people are still in media because they were influenced by that. You know, some are actors, some are musicians, somehow of creative realm because they found
that
they could focus
That's incredible.
On that. And that was my experience 2 years in Laredo, Texas. Mm-hmm. And then I was burned out.
In your burnout.
Yeah. And I was like, I can't do this anymore. This is a very harsh place, you know.
Yeah.
And I went to Miami, Florida, and I was there with a nonprofit organization. And I worked with them for 6 years, working
Doing
with
what?
Indigenous groups, again, documenting the life
yep.
of people in Peru, in Costa Rica, in Cuba, documenting what, you know, the good that people can do. And also, this time around was different. I didn't feel like I was fulfilling that white savior complex, going to these countries and showing them how good we are in the United States and how much we can help them. It was more like training people that were locals.
Yeah.
To have the tools to do good things in their communities.
Yeah.
It wasn't there to impose
Lasting
our way.
Lasting change.
But it was like, oh, you want to learn more about media? I'll give you the tools. But you take off, you know, with that and do amazing stories. Like you wouldn't believe. Just one of them is like, I don't even remember. I think it was 2004. I went to Cuba and I had a workshop, a cinematography workshop. People from the government came. People from the church came. People from, you know, regular standard of living came. And they took my workshop. But there was this kid, Axel, who was very eager to learn. And like, young kid, like, I left a computer there with like iMovie or something. And he took the computer. And he was editing stuff. Every once in a while, I heard news about Axel doing things and whatever. He made a little documentary project and they won an award at a festival in Canada.
Wow.
So he applied for a special visa so he could receive his award. So he went to the award ceremony with his wife and defected from Cuba, walked from Canada, crossed the border into the U.S. and went to Lee University to study filmmaking. Now he's in Hollywood as a producer working in the film industry. So I'm not taking credit for
also,
that.
How does that feel?
He did that on his own, but there was a seed that in some way was planted along the way, you know. And like, again, I'm not saying he's the result of my, no, I'm just saying it was a privilege for me to deposit something in him that later on helped him to become what he is right now.
Let me ask you about that, because you started off earlier, you talked about, you know, kind of the uncovering and polishing and finding the gold in people. And that's one thing, I barely know you, but I know enough about you to know, because I mean, you did that with me. You were poured into me like on the movie set and were so kind and generous, and you can feel that about your presence. Also, your heart sometimes, I know mine, can sometimes get so hard just from disappointment, assholes, you know, people who disappoint you. You have seen so much, you know, so how do you like keep that empathy where you see the golden people when also there's so much sometimes that can get, you know, that wall?
I think that's part of what contributes to the burnout sometimes. It's not your, not only your physical investment, but not seeing the results.
I could preach. You know, yes.
That is really hard.
Yes.
So sometimes the best you can do is say, I planted, probably not going to see the harvest in this relationship or in this endeavor, or I gave them the tools and they just didn't want to use them. They didn't know how to use them, and then move on and detach yourself. Maybe along the way, later after years, you will learn something happened. Sometimes you don't even know. But if I was to kid myself, like digging and pushing it and forcing it, I'll lose myself trying to see fruit where maybe I was there just for a season and I wasn't there to see the whole thing through, you know? That's one way to see it.
But detaching, you have an empathetic heart.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Detaching yourself in a way of like, this is as much as I can give of myself here.
Yeah.
And I have to learn to also see my potential in moving on and not being afraid of starting something new.
Yeah.
And not cursing it.
Right.
Because that's another thing. Sometimes we move on and we say,
Yeah,
exactly. It's just letting it where it was. Sometimes.
Yeah.
There will be fruit surrounded by a bunch of weeds and you only see the weeds.
Mm.
You just have to pull the weeds out. But your burnt out mentality, your fear, your anger, your bitterness that I have experienced many times doesn't let you see beyond the weeds. You know,
that's good.
There was something there and you don't know.
Yeah.
And you might not see it. But that's one way that I have to address some of those things. There are relationships that I invested and they just turn sour.
Yeah.
And I could turn sour myself.
Yeah.
Or I can just work on myself, detach myself from that relationship. There's nothing wrong. Like, we are not here to make everybody happy, to save people, to, you know what I'm saying? Maybe it comes around. You don't know. Maybe it comes around.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to condemn myself for not trying hard enough.
Yeah.
Or after everything that I did for this project and look how they backstabbed me.
Mm.
It's like, let me move on to the next project and see if something that I learned in this can give much fruit.
That's healthy. That's a healthy outlook.
But sometimes talk about, you know, the word toxic relation, which I don't like very much, but it's now used to like everything's toxic. Maybe you're toxic too, and you just have to learn, you know?
That could preach.
You know, maybe the stink is like under your nose.
Yeah.
And you're just going around and everything stinks.
Toxic.
No, just wipe your nose, dude.
Yeah.
That's where the stink is coming from.
Mm.
And sometimes in those experiences, you learn to reflect on that and see, like, oh, let me wipe it off. It was actually me. It wasn't the places that I was.
That's a good word.
It wasn't the relationships that I was building. You know, there's a pattern here, and it's not me fleeing from these things, is me finding like, oh, I have to work on myself.
Yeah.
You know, before I move on also to the next thing. So it goes hand in hand, you know. I need to learn how to move on. But I need to learn also how to grow from this experience and not flee from one thing to another without learning. You know?
I could preach.
And in that, we're going to be there growing and changing. And that's part of leadership. You know, there's a difference between being a manager and being a leader.
Mm-hmm.
Because the leader, the manager will help to keep things functioning,
yeah,
and manage things, you know, keep working. You can be a manager for many years. And as long as you're doing your job, so, and that's good. We have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But we can also take on leadership,
yeah,
which involves changing and motivating people as well. Not to be the status quo if it's not working, but like
calling up to be
as
more.
Well. Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think as creatives, sometimes we've been told, no, you have to manage the expectations of your client. You have to manage the expectations of your audience.
Yeah.
You have to, you know, juggle with all these personal life and work balance things, you know.
Yeah.
And in reality, it's beyond being a manager and taking the role of like, okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to shift this environment that is not working for me. But I'm going to learn as well. If there's an issue why it's not working in his mind, I'll better work in my issues so that I don't carry that into the next endeavor that I do. And I keep blaming other people for what is actually something that's not working in my process at the time.
I'm going to press into that just a little bit more, the leadership piece. This show's called Unconventional Leaders. Mm-hmm. And it's a show for creatives, and I have the word leader in there, and it seems kind of like I've gotten some resistance. Some people have been like, "Well, I'm not a leader. I'm a creative. Like I tell stories, you know." And I'm really pushing into that because I feel like creatives, that is a form of leadership because you are, you know, seeing things that other people don't see and bringing to the surface messages that most people won't hear. And that's influence, and leadership is influence. And I'm just curious, you talk a lot about leadership. It comes up in topics whenever I talk to you. And this is your world, is this piece. So how do you see what you do as a form of leadership when it's art?
Mm-hmm. I love history, you know. And if you look at history, there is a very important place for the artist in society.
Mm.
So in history, at least in the medieval times, they were called the balladeers.
Okay.
So the common people, the people that didn't know Greek or Latin, you know, the common people will not read, they didn't even know how to read, but they will not read the works of the philosophers and the thinkers and the high-minded people. Mm-hmm. But the artist will take those works, translate them into ballads, music, or theater, or forms of art, and then rephrase them into a language that the regular common people will consume. Look at the life of Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, being a master, being not only in the religious topics, but understanding, you know, the life, the complexity of good and evil, and who better theology professor could be than Jesus at 12 years old, just teaching, you know. But if you see, he was a storyteller. He chose to be a storyteller, almost like a balladeer, like an artist who can take the high-minded, complex things of theology and life and then disseminate it into stories. Now, it's important to think that he wasn't always explaining the stories.
Mm.
Sometimes he would just tell the story.
Yep.
And then they will come and say, what's the meaning behind this? You know, it's like sometimes he will explain it, but not most of the time. And we feel as artists, not only that we have to tell the story, but that we have to explain the story. Good.
That's so good.
And the people are dumb because they're not getting what we're trying to tell.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just that we're called to tell the story.
Mm.
Sometimes we get the chance to explain it. Other times, the story should be strong enough that people will get what they need to get.
What they need to hear. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm
And so, as storytellers, we're great at talking. Look at us, you know? We're not so great at listening.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, we're great storytellers, not great story listeners.
Mm.
But a good storyteller practices leadership in the sense of a leader is a great communicator that is able, through effective communication, challenge and motivate people to give and to do their best.
Gosh, that's so well said.
You know, so communication becomes so key in the role of a leader. You can't force people, but you can communicate that can motivate to change. Yeah. Right. So as artists, whether it be a filmmaker or a painter or a musician, you are communicating a message. And like I told you before, the message is not good or bad. It's a medium, right?
Yeah.
Or the media becomes a medium. And then whatever you're communicating through that is what really makes a difference. And so as communicators, I believe our role in the context of leadership is to be able to see the potential that we have. In the generation of influencers, we need more leaders.
Come on.
Because we have plenty of influencers, you know?
Yeah.
And why do we see a crisis of leadership in general?
In general.
Look at politics alone.
Yep.
Not only in the United States, around the world.
Yeah.
There are not many people running for office in many countries, not only the United States. What is that telling you?
Mm.
Not that the society is rigged and women don't have a chance. More than any other place in history, women have opportunities that they didn't have before.
That's true.
You know, what's happening? What kind of narrative are we consuming and regurgitating that is not enabling people to take on the role that they're supposed to take as leaders? Look at education. Yeah. Oh, our educational system is not what it used to be, and we're just so consumed with it.
Mm.
Yeah, we have a crisis because nobody wants to be a teacher.
Yeah.
Well, I'm exaggerating. That's not nobody, but it's now one of those professions that is disregarded and is one of the most influential positions you can get.
Preach.
I've been a teacher myself, both in secondary school and in higher education. You know, and I've experienced both sides, and I have plenty of experiences to say the importance of being a teacher, you know.
Mm.
But we don't take it as a role of leadership. We take it as a, in our societies, a means to make some
money.
But we can't do something else, you know.
Yeah.
Look at not only leadership in politics and education, but even in science. How I'm assertive of this because we don't trust science, we don't trust education, and we don't trust politics.
Yeah.
And if there is a crisis of trust, it's because there is a crisis of leaders that inspire trust in people. They're not communicating effectively to produce that trust. So there's two main components to leadership is communication and trust.
Mm.
And if we lack those two things, that's when we have crisis. And I love to bring, there's a whole talk we can do about beekeeping, but I love to bring, beekeeping leadership. That is the best, you know, analogy you can get. But there's, you know, as a beekeeper myself, there are great analogies when it comes to leadership. And one of those is before the interview, we were talking about the communication between the bees and how the whole reproduction of the hive depends on the communication.
Mm-hmm.
And before becoming a beekeeper, my understanding of the beehive is like there's the queen.
Yeah.
And then all the bees that are working to sustain the queen and cater to the queen. And
she's in charge.
That is not true.
Yeah.
That the queen is just another worker, works as hard and if not harder than the other bees for the good of the colony.
Mm.
The bee lays over 2,000 eggs a day.
Oh, wow.
She's so busy laying eggs.
I bet.
That sometimes she can't even feed herself. So there are nursing bees that will feed the queen while going around laying eggs.
Jeez.
And when the queen dies, the bees immediately start sounding an alarm. The queen is dead. And they start feeding royal jelly it's like a special type of honey to a new bee that will now become their queen and work just
That's
as
incredible.
Hard. You know, there are bees that are undertakers. They take in the dead bodies inside the colony and then flying with the bodies outside and disposing them so that there's no disease inside the colony. There are bees that are scouts and they go out and they find resources and they come back and they do this dance. They wiggle their wings and they go wiggle around and then to the other side. And each of those little movements communicate either the direction from the hive in relationship to the sun, where they have resources, the distance, how many kilometers they have to travel to get to that specific location, the time of day, different ways that they communicate. And all of them are communicating. And at one point, they all communicate in this, they listen to each other, and they come to an agreement between them.
Hmm.
And the colony splits in two, and they form a new colony.
It's with wild. The queen.
Part of the problem is like what's happening here. We're listening to each other, but sometimes we're quiet, but we're not listening.
Mm-hmm.
We're just formulating our next argument.
100%.
And just letting the person finish
100%.
The stuff so we can go and interject.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah.
This is what. But we miss the chance to really learn by listening. Again, good storytellers, bad story listeners. And by listening to somebody's story, I can enhance my story as a creative. I can become a better leader when I enhance my ability to communicate, but to inspire trust. That combination is what's going to make a difference. But we don't trust media anymore. There is
no.
A huge lack of trust to media because we're sold out to many other ideas that we don't even believe ourselves,
yeah.
You know, as
yeah.
part of people in the film industry and media related, we don't even trust the unions. We don't trust the studios. And so if we live in a society that continues to go that path, it will happen just like with the beast, a colony collapse.
Yep.
And our society could collapse as well because we're not functioning for the good of the hive or the good of society.
Mm.
We're functioning for the good of myself.
Mm.
And we have to transition from that mentality of me to the mentality of we.
Mm.
And in the film industry, what's working right now is things like this,
yeah.
where people meet and they talk.
Yep.
And it's to the growth, the mutual
yeah.
growth.
Yeah.
And it's to enhance the experience of one another, and it's to listen. And maybe in that buzzing, in that wiggling, we can find the resources we need to survive as an industry.
You have to write a book. Okay?
Okay.
So I can buy it and I can read it. There's like so many good little tidbits in here. Are we good on time?
Yeah,
your wife get back?
Because we can
sure.
make multiple episodes.
Yes, I want to make sure. So you're in Miami. And you're working with this nonprofit, and you're telling more story. Actually, it's different now because you're going in and you're training two
mm-hmm.
folks in media in different countries. How long did you do that, and then where did you go from
six
there?
6 years.
6 years.
Yeah,
okay.
6 years until my.
Did you say you burn out again?
Yeah, I did.
Do you burn out?
Yeah, until I burn out. But also, I found these like huge challenges, like my visa expired or was about to expire, and as much as I tried doing it the right way, I got denied again and again.
Mm.
3 times I got denied. I hired lawyers to represent me and they stole my money and they didn't represent me at all. And I was so frustrated, so devastated until one of the lawyers told me, why don't you stop paying lawyers like me? Go to school and get a student visa in the meantime until you get another status. So you're not out of status.
Right.
Notice that I didn't say illegal.
Right.
I said out of status.
Yeah.
You know, that word illegal implies.
Implies some 100%.
But in my case, you know, out of status means I could go back to my country, but I couldn't come back here to the life that I already had, you know.
Mm.
So it was one of those challenging moments, you know, challenging places where you can't think much of the future. Because you can't buy a car or a house, because what if I get deported and I have to go back and then I lose whatever, like
what
it's
you've built,
very,
yeah.
It's a very difficult situation. I really feel for the people that are going through things like that, you know, in that immigrant story, like people has become so political that sometimes we dehumanize that.
That could preach.
In
yes.
In my case,
yes.
You know, I think even Jesus was an immigrant in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
With his family, fleeing from the violence of his country. And he grew up, his teenage year, he spent them in Egypt, a completely different culture. Egypt was the United States of the time, you know?
Yeah.
And he was a refugee.
Mm.
But now we think of refugees and immigrants as some...
criminal.
Yeah, or you know, the deplorables.
And, yeah.
You know, but I was in a position like that. And I went to school. and I studied filmmaking because it was the closest thing to me.
Yeah.
And I befriended the teachers and they start telling me next semester, do not sign up for my class because I need you to work on a project with me. Sign up with somebody else so that we can work together.
Wow.
So I worked for a couple of teachers in different projects, including weddings. I did weddings at the time. But it was very special because I learned, like, I did this whole storytelling of the documentary and then I translated it into wedding videos. And the wedding videos
were
they were
fire.
Unique.
I bet they were good.
Because he was like, oh, it's not just documenting the day. It's translating some of these five keywords into what is important about this wedding.
Wow.
And it make every wedding very unique because it was focused on the way to tell their story.
Wow.
And although visually it might have similarities in terms of like the content of the videos was very unique, very different. They feel like that was that video was crafted for me and not the same as everybody else. So I learned throughout those 4 years working in university, I couldn't necessarily work on something else because I had a student visa.
Yeah.
So it was a work related to the field that I was studying and it came through my teachers. And then I met my wife from Venezuela. Then Lucas came along. My wife was a resident. And through her, I received my residency.
She was what?
A resident.
Oh, I thought you said arrested. I said, what'd she do?
Sorry. That Colombian accent coming out. She was a resident, a U.S. resident.
Yeah, okay.
And I became a resident myself.
Oh.
Sometimes I'll go to school with my son. And of course, kid cannot go in a classroom, you know. But they really were very understandable of my disposition, my situation. And sometimes the teachers would allow me to go in the corner with my son in a little kangaroo smelling like poo. Aww. And I would take classes like that, you know. So my wife was working. I finished, graduated from Miami-Dade College from filmmaking school. I started my independent work. I was not working with the nonprofit organization anymore. And I started Vida Extrema as a production company and I started hiring my classmates.
Really?
So film school wasn't necessarily experience for me to learn the art of filmmaking. Although I learned a lot of stuff because, you know, I didn't have some of the traditional understanding and knowledge of the American cinema. You know, the studio, like a lot of what we learn in Latin America and Europe is very different from what you learn here in filmmaking school. But it was mostly connections. Connections that up to this day I still cultivate and have broad business and relationships and clients and different things like that. So that's kind of my transition through the time in Miami until I fell burnt out.
Okay.
Yeah. And I saw Georgia as a possibility to start again and do something different.
So to kind of bring us home here, one thing you have brought up over and over again is this idea of getting burnout. And thank you for being vulnerable enough to say that and to share that, because I don't think there's anyone listening who isn't like, I feel that in my bones. And sometimes there's a lot of shame wrapped around, you know, well, if it's something you love to do, you know, aren't you grateful? Aren't you grateful for this or that? And surely, you know, you're thrilled with the experiences that you've had, but also giving your heart so much and you put in the work. Like I've seen you work and you put every little detail you are 100% in. And after a while, it gets to you. And you haven't burned out of storytelling and creativity. You've shifted gears quite a bit and you've given yourself permission to do that, which says a lot, you know. I'm just curious, you know, as a reflection, looking back on all these burnout periods and probably still feeling it at some times, how do you advise, encourage creatives who, I guess, struggle even though they love what they're doing?
Well,
that's a big question. I'm sorry.
Because I like storytelling and analogies and metaphors. One metaphor is the machete, you know? The knife that the peasants use to cut grass, you know, the machete. You get two people with a machete cutting grass, you know, and they're going at it at one point, one of them stops and, you know, stops cutting. The other one is going, going. And after a while, that one that stops goes back and it catch up with the other one and surpasses him. So the other one's like, how do you make it? It's like, I stopped and I took a rock and I was filing the machete until it becomes sharp. So he needed to take a break and sharpen the machete. And sometimes when we feel the struggle of going at it, we're effective, we're good at it. But at one point, we have to stop.
Oh, I got chills.
Take a break. It takes time.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to find a rock, a hard place.
Yeah.
And just, and you're going to see other people advancing and you're going to compare yourself and you're going to go on Instagram and you're going to swipe and all you're going to see is people hustling and advancing. And you feel like, what am I doing? Taking a break here. I feel so useless. I base my identity in what I can do. But then you go back at it and you catch up and then you progress and then you learn.
Yeah.
Okay, next time around, I'm going to value those times where I can stop. Sometimes you do it gladly. Other times you're forced to sharpen the machete because it's so dull that you're hurting yourself. You know, that the work that you do is hurting you. And I've been hurt from these things, you know, from the necessity to hustle, the necessity to prove myself in this industry, to where my machete is not only dull, but my hands are bleeding, you know, my heart is hardened.
You're making me cry.
Know? I don't want to go anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and then I have to be forced into rest.
Yeah.
You know, there's a great, I think my grandmother taught me my first memorized Bible verse in Spanish. El Señor es mi pastor, nada me faltará. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall lack nothing. He made me lay down in green paths. Because sometimes we don't want to lay down.
Preach.
You know, sometimes we have to be made to lay down.
Yeah.
To rest. It isn't coming to my crib, it's coming to my rest. You know, rest is just as important. It seems like it's the goal of what we're striving for.
We tell ourselves that.
You know what I'm saying? We're striving to get into that
place. Yeah.
You know, we're working hard so we can retire and enjoy. When we don't have any more strength to enjoy.
You're so right.
So when people talk about sabbatical living, it makes sense, you know? Every 7 years or something, you take a year and you enjoy and you break down your retirement into these chunks.
I haven't heard of that. That's interesting.
No,
that's wild.
The sabbatical life is every 7 years you break for a year, you take your family to another country or wherever you are,
and you rest the
and
whole
you
year.
Rest and you live out of the savings that you make during those 7 years, and then you project yourself for the next 7 years.
Wow.
So when you come with your machete sharpened to advance even more, and you do it as a unity.
Wow.
You know, it's not like everybody on their own side. No, it's like, let's target this, you know? So I've taken, not a full year, but I've taken this full month in Brazil with my family and time in Colombia. And even here, when we came throughout the pandemic, I realized this is our sabbatical, you know? It's the time to stop and realize whether we make it out of this pandemic or not.
Yeah.
Like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
I started my little farm that you saw in the backyard, you know, and people come and see, oh, wow, you really knew about... No, I didn't have any experience. I've seen my animals die because of my lack of knowledge and my inexperience. You know, I've been responsible of like my neighbor's yard being decimated by my chickens and having to learn how to control that. And I'm learning by those things. It's very frustrating sometimes when I make some mistakes that I thought I was ready to not make those mistakes again. But then I have to have a little bit of compassion on myself. Not self-pity or self, not in a negative way, but just look at myself and say, hey, I wasn't born a farmer. I'm learning. I wasn't born a communicator, a leader, or a filmmaker. I'm learning. I'm in the process of getting to that. And I think my advice in summary is sharpen your tool. Take the time to rest and sharpen your tool. Nobody's forcing you to hustle to the place where you not only dislike what you like, but you dislike who you are.
Man, that's strong. I don't think I've done literally hundreds of these with various shows and stuff. And I don't think I've ever been like, I don't know, cried in one of these. You just literally made me cry. It was so, so meaningful. I want to have one final question, but I want to give you an opportunity to share where people can connect with you. And then I also want to thank you because you didn't have to say yes. I think I've been bothering you for a little while. I'm like, I want to interview you.
I know.
But still, it's your time. It's valuable. Thank you. I don't take it for granted. And I just really appreciate because what you shared here, I know whenever it moves me, then thinking about all the people who needed to hear that, it's really going to bless some people. So thank you. Where would you want to point our listeners to? Because you're going to be making some content pretty soon and they need to be following you, right?
Yeah, of course.
You see how three under the bus there?
But, well, first of all, I was talking to my friend on the way here to set up the cameras. Mm-hmm. And I said, man, you're going to meet Heather and she's awesome and she's doing this project and there's so much potential. And the very best thing is the consistency.
Yeah.
And like how consistent she's been. Regardless of how the videos look one day, the next day, you know, sometimes there's not necessarily like visual consistency, but it's the consistency of doing it again and again to where it's not only the consistency of doing it, sometimes it's the consistency of not doing it the same way. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. Like I know exactly what you're saying.
It's like sometimes you realize like, oh, consistency is not being stubborn and doing the wrong thing again and again.
No.
Consistency sometimes can be the pivoting. Consistency of working to better what you're doing. Or to the consistency to understand like at this stage, this is working. I don't have to work for it to improve now.
Yeah.
I have to work to understand this now before I can move to the better and the next thing.
Yeah.
You know, I don't need to buy the very next camera just because it's working.
Yeah.
I might need to polish other tools that I have before I can move into buying. 90% of the time, people ask me, what camera can I get for my podcast or for my content? And I'm like, this camera is very good. You know, what you have in your hand with your phone is very good. But my old teacher used to say, might not be very politically correct anymore, but he said, it's not the arrow that kills you. It's the Indian behind the arrow. So it's not the tool that is necessarily as effective. We have amazing tools right now that are enabling us to get to content and things. So, but I think, and I want to, you know, really acknowledge and commend you for the ability to be persistent and consistent, even when I know things don't show the way we want. But
thank you.
I'm privileged to be with you to share with you. I sometimes understand the things that you're realizing that are visually attractive, but then I'm like, okay, I see that catch my eye because there's something more important behind it. And the subtitles and the, you know, there's, it might not play with everybody, but with the people that do play, like it calls attention for the people that want to understand your content, what is important beyond how it looks, beyond how short or how long.
Yes.
Those are things that can change. Like I say, quality is a matter of buying it, you know, but your vision is something you can't buy. And, you know, keep investing in your vision and the quality will come. And one day you'll have a staff of people that are going to easy the rest of the things. You don't have to do everything alone.
Yes, sir.
But even at that time, I see the importance of, because sometimes when we have staff and we have more people helping us, then we feel like we have to show them how to use the machete.
Yeah.
You know, even when it's dull, we can show that we're stopping and we can show that we're polishing because that might be interpreted as weakness. And we were sharing about how I've been told not to share some of these personal struggles that I've had with anxiety and depression and panic attacks.
Yeah.
And and financial situations yeah. sometimes and doubt and fear of the future. Don't share that because, you know, people are going to think you're weak. You know, people are going to think that you're mixing too much of your personality. Don't post so many things about your family and your kids. Focus on the professional stuff.
Yeah.
But that's not real life. At least that's not the life that we actually lead, you know?
Right.
And I'm not advocating for everybody to go and put all the dirty laundry out. But I'm just advocating that for us to be more real, more empathic, more, you know, true leaders that can really listen and that can inspire, not only become influencers, but true leaders that can inspire people to trust us.
Yes, sir.
And if we're showing an image of ourselves that is not aligned with reality, how can we expect people to trust us, really, you know?
Yeah.
And if that is a key element of leadership, then we need to sharpen that. People can learn more about what I'm doing and who I am, both things, what I'm doing, who I am, through social media. You know, they can find me on Instagram at Andres Cuervo. And they can also find my work on my website, which is carloscuervo.com, because my first name is Carlos and my second name is Andres. So many people go confused, like, are you Carlos or are you Andres?
I was confused at first.
Andres is like, what is going? I'm like, I'm Hispanic. And once you understand that, you know the whole ordeal. Like I always. So, carloscuervo.com and in most social media platforms by Andres Cuervo.
Excellent.
I'm working on different commercial projects, narrative projects. This is a time that the industry is being really challenged in many aspects. People are not having as much work as they used to. People are not getting paid the rates that they were used to. Even with prices going up, people are still getting paid less than what they used to charge. My goal for this year is I'm going to make my own content, but I'm also going to create this platform where people feel like they have the freedom to express through this platform.
So cool.
So you can find more of that, different shows that we're in the process of creating.
I can't wait.
That is again, sometimes I don't even identify with what the shows are necessarily about, but I'm willing to learn, you know, and I'm willing to see what's in front of me and find the heart of the story that people want to share.
Gosh, I've learned so much today. This has been so helpful. I have one final question I ask all our guests. And that is, what is something, and it can be anything, what is something that you are deeply questioning right now that you don't have the answer to? And it can be something small, like, why does Taco Bell have bean burritos with onions in it? Or it could be something really deep. But something, and the reason for this question is, it's good to ask questions. It's good to not always have the answers. It's good to be curious and explore. And I'm just curious with you in this season of your life, what is something that's been on your mind a lot lately that you're questioning?
Getting old.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm questioning, like, how much we've been told to hate getting old.
How old are you?
I'm 42.
You're 42. Okay.
But I know, like, I'm questioning that mindset of, like, what is it really to age, you know?
That's so good.
I've been questioning that a lot, you know, because you start feeling your body telling you things, you know. You start feeling your mind not being as sharp. You know? It's true. It does happen. My dad is in the hospital right now, and I see how he's changing and aging. And I'm like, I want to learn. I don't understand what would be the best way to age well, I guess. Yeah. I want to learn. Because right now it's in my mind often, you know, the question of how is it to age well or how is it to prepare for that? Or I don't know. That's something I'm debating with.
And because I'm 37, so I'm, you know, getting close to that 40 mark. So that's been on my mind a lot too lately. And, you know, especially as a woman,
middle-age crisis is real, sister.
Yeah. Hopefully that won't be middle-age. Hopefully it's not. But you're, you know, God willing, you know, we're healthy. We take care of ourselves. If you think about what's considered old in our culture, isn't even halfway done with our lives. And most of our life is spent old.
Yeah. Remember I talk about Dickens, you know, Roger Dickens, the cinematographer. He didn't start as a cinematographer when he was young. He started as a cinematographer when he was past 40.
Yes, I love that.
And so many people are, you know, they didn't start their major accomplishments until they were what this today's society is considering old for the TikTok vibe.
Yeah. You know?
And so that's part of what's challenging my mind. Like rewiring my brain to say, hey, I'm not done yet.
Come on.
You know?
Yeah.
Maybe my best years are still ahead. Even with everything that I've gone through. Like
best years.
Sometimes I feel like Forrest Gump, you know. With like living in so many
You've had a crazy life.
And what if the best is yet to come?
Come on. Come on. Carlos, thank you for doing this. This is awesome.
Awesome.